right, we have one case remaining on our 9 o'clock. Well, it's actually our 10:30 docket. You all were so early, we're getting you in early. Moore versus State of Texas. If the clerk will please announce counsel. Ms. Williams.
May it please the court. In the case of the State v. Moore, we have three issues that have been briefed One is the abuse of discretion by the court not allowing new counsel when requested by the defendant.
What is your position on that? I mean, do you think that, surely you don't think that a pro se has a right to new counsel anytime he wants it, because you can see what would happen.
And I completely agree. It's not something to encourage. At all. And there's a string of cases that came all the way back to 1974, which I would like to point out in my brief. I have transposed the two King cases, the 1974 case and the 2000 case. But when you follow that line of cases and you finally get to Hill, which is the most current in that line, Hill points out that you must have a hearing when you have articulable facts that rise to the level of possibly needing new counsel.
And what facts did we read here other than we don't get along? And what articulable facts are those in this case?
I don't think they were very graceful, but I think he did bring up the issue that there is a possible conflict of interest. He doesn't give any details in his letter. But he attempts to.
But didn't he testify on the day of trial when she tried to withdraw and he didn't say one word about that? He just said their personalities didn't mesh, but never said anything about there being a conflict or some ethics problem?
Yes, you're correct that the record does not reflect that. However, in this case, we're dealing, if you look at the line of cases of King, in all of them, you have, defendants that have gone through the revolving door. In this case, we have a first-time offender, and I think there should be the distinction. If you look at the Watkins case out of Waco, they suggest that when we get to the level of adequate cause, and in this case, it is the conflict of interest claim, that because of there not being a hearing on it, there is nothing in the record to support it.
Day of trial, there was a hearing, and he testified.
Yes, and he was being questioned by the same counsel that he was attempting to remove. I would argue that the Watkins case suggests that a defendant that brings a decent question, one that could get his counsel recused or removed from the case, should be allowed a hearing with a counsel that he's not in disjunction with.
That's new counsel.
Pardon?
That's new counsel.
Only for the hearing of the removal.
Do you understand how that would affect the dockets of criminal courts to try it? So you can say some ambiguous, vague assertion in a letter that there's a conflict. So now you get new counsel to represent you at a hearing. Do you understand the effect?
I do understand the effect of that, which is why we're not asking for a broad, open-ended exception. We're asking for a narrowly tailored one.
Just for your client?
No. Particularly for the individuals who have never been through the felony system before. They don't know what's going on. They haven't had the opportunity to be previously disposed to it. And they're stuck with what they have.
So you're a first-timer. You have certain rights that a second-timer doesn't? Okay. That's a rhetorical question.
And
what standard of review do you perceive that we are looking at
You're looking, yes, you're looking at abuse of discretion. When we, pardon?
We need to decide that the trial court abused its discretion by not appointing new counsel to see if we were entitled to new counsel. Is that what you're suggesting?
I'm suggesting that in this particular case, the facts warrant that the court should have appointed new counsel for him, for the appellant. In regards to, and it all comes down to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim that is throughout our brief, that the counsel that was given to Mr. Moore was less than effective, and in my opinion falls below normal standards for defense counsel. For example, she was not prepared for trial. She told the court on the day of trial that she was not prepared, and she asked to withdraw. He denied that. She asked for a continuance. It was denied. As you read through the record, you also find that in regards to the video, which is at the crux of the appeal, that although she had been given a copy of it by by the state, she claimed surprise over and over and over again that it was being used. She did not object, contrary to what state would have you believe, to a 403 objection as to the prejudicial value at the punishment phase. At the trial phase, but her motion in limine is to surprise. Again, even at the punishment phase, she asked for another continuance to prepare to rebut the video.
Well, maybe that was your lead dog argument, that the trial court abused its discretion by not granting a continuance, which is pretty tough, but so is this.
Correct. Well, I think in regards to ineffective assistance of counsel claim, if you, under Strickland, you look at the totality of the representation, and from beginning to end, it is lacking. When she asked to be removed at the beginning of trial, the day of trial, asked for a continuance, and even at the very end, the last shot in the arm to the defendant is that she never asked the question of whether or not he had a felony criminal history, which he did not. She parades 5, I believe, witnesses of family across the witness stand and never once asked them, does he have a criminal record?
Well, isn't that something that, I mean, as I understand the range of punishment, the minimum is 15. He wasn't going to get probation, so she wasn't qualifying him for probation. Isn't that something that's trial strategy that perhaps on an ineffective assistance on a writ you have the opportunity to develop?
Your Honor, I see no possible trial strategy in not letting a jury know that your client has no criminal has no prior criminal history.
I thought, and you're more familiar record than I am, but I thought it, the wording was he had no felony history.
He has no felony history, yes,
oh,
Your Honor.
Well, that,
sorry.
That's a difference, isn't it?
Yes, it is, and I apologize.
The door to something by saying, he, ladies and gentlemen, he has no felony history, and here comes the state with a rap sheet that's, you know, six or eight inches long.
In this case, we don't have one.
He
has one misdemeanor from just Cook
one.
County, just one.
Four.
Theft?
Okay,
theft,
just,
I believe.
I'm just thinking maybe it's better not to bring in any criminal history than say he has no felonies and let the state say, well, he's got a, you know.
He's got a misdemeanor theft. When... If again, if you're looking at this case in its totality and you look at this video, which is quite frankly very damaging, he's boisterous, he's pompous. And then you parade family going, oh, he's all better. The only counterbalance to this damaging video that was taken a year and a half earlier is the fact that he has no felony criminal history, and his first time out of the gate, he gets charged with something that has no probation eligibility to it. Even Juror Jones pointed out that had he known that there was no prior felony history, he thinks the verdict would be different. Now, it's one thing to get into the impressions of a juror under 606B. We just really can't go there. But when you have a juror come into your office with an article from the newspaper saying, this is what the newspaper says, that he has no prior criminal history or no prior felony history, what did I do? It makes you pause and wonder what really happened in that courtroom. And when you get into the record, you find that his defense attorney did very little. But for the state doing a little corrective measuring, she many times attempted to walk into reversible error. And I think she did with the fact that she did not bring up the no prior felony history. I really urge the court, and although I don't want to be responsible for this as a defense attorney, I really urge this court to make a bright line rule that if there is no serious criminal history or no felony criminal history, it's per se ineffective assistance of counsel if you don't let a jury know it, because it does make a difference. State would make you, would have you believe that it's illogical to make that jump, but it's not.
Well, you know, we can't have that bright line rule. I mean, because we're going to have, okay, I have one misdemeanor. Is that, what if they have 46 misdemeanors? I mean, that there is no bright line, because somewhere you might be right. If there's just one misdemeanor, you definitely should let them know there's no felony. On the other hand, if there's 46 misdemeanors, that's a whole different ballgame. So there couldn't be a bright line rule, I don't think. It'd be a judgment call on the severity, the nature, and the number of misdemeanors.
I see your point. However, as a defense attorney, if you don't have any prior felony history, I think the jury needs to know that. And I think it needs to be defense counsel's responsibility to bring it to their attention. And in this case, we have a counsel who's done very little and doesn't even try, doesn't even attempt. In regards to the extraneous offenses that were allowed in at the punishment phase, the state quotes Bible in that you don't have to have corroboration to prove prior bad acts or extraneous offenses. I don't think they're entirely wrong. However, if you look at the line of cases, Bible, Montgomery, and Padron, you'll see that in each of those cases, we have some serious offenders, previous offenders, that are being dealt with in each of those cases. And I would argue to you that in Montgomery, they say those extraneous offenses were just a small nudge. And that's kind of the standard that they give it. It's a small nudge, so it doesn't make too much of a difference, therefore we'll let it in. But in this case, it's not a small nudge. It's a slam on the head, because we have the defendant's statements, again, that are rather pompous, that he manufactured drugs. He's been doing it forever. He's done it all over the county. He's done this, he's done that. And he just goes on and on and on. And there is no corroboration for it. And where I'm not trying to argue that we need corroboration, because I think the Court of Criminal Appeals has made that pretty clear, I would like to point out that in this particular case, trial counsel did nothing to get to the Montgomery balancing test.
Because this is all part of your ineffective assistance argument, because you really don't have an issue on that the extraneous offenses were admitted and they shouldn't have been in the punishment phase. I mean, that's not one of your points, correct?
May I respond to that?
Yes, yeah.
It is one of my points, but it does go more to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Williams. Mr. McGohey, is that correct?
McGoy,
okay. And by the way, it's nice to have people from Montague and Nakona. Usually we don't get travelers from afar down here. So thank you.
May it please the court and counsel. What I would respond in with regard to the claim that the appellant was denied new counsel is that, first of all, I think counsel misquotes or misleads the court with respect to Hill, which in fact says that a defendant is not entitled to new counsel, whatever he brings to the court's attention, unless he requests a hearing. And what I would point out in this case is that the appellant never does that. On any of his motions, any of his letters that he sends to the court. And in fact, what he raises to the court, I think counsel here argues that Watson, the Waco court case, somehow creates or tries to create a new exception, saying that, okay, if you don't file the, or if you don't ask for a hearing on it, you don't get it. And that Watkins comes along and says, well, we'll go ahead and consider the matters raised in all the notes or letters that the appellant sent to the court. Prior to trial, if they raise reasonable issues that might have led to him getting new counsel appointed. I don't think Watkins does that, certainly not consciously, but even if you argue on the court's part, but even if you argue that is the case and that an appellant who raises specific matters that alarm the court to the point it thinks a hearing should be held to determine their truth or allow some extrapolation from them, that's not done here. Given the best look you can take on Watson from the defense standpoint, what you get here is a series of notes and letters to the court where he complains that his trial counsel is trying to get him to turn state's evidence, that there's a conflict of interest which he does not specify, that he doesn't like the state's offer. That's perhaps the only thing that he carries over to the end of the matter just before trial when counsel files her own motion for continuance and motion to withdraw, and he says again he just does not like the state's offer, thinks a new counsel could get him a better offer. He quotes relatives, this is not even from his own experience, but quotes relatives saying that counsel has told them that a bond reduction is not worthwhile to seek from the court. Again, in another note, that there's a conflict of interest because counsel's representing someone associated with my cases without being specific, and I really don't know to this day who that would be. Certainly he doesn't spell it out in anything he sends to the court. Again, counsel's reluctant to seek bond reduction, and he wants to fire his attorney, which the court, in responding to him, very properly says, look, you can't fire your attorney. You're stuck with the one that's appointed for you unless you show reason why you should have another one, why one should be discharged and you should have another. I don't think the court's written response to him cuts him off from that avenue. In fact, it tells him basically he's got a burden here, which he does under the law, to show why he should get new counsel. It's not enough to say he doesn't like the advice he's getting, that he doesn't mesh with his attorney, as he says in that final hearing. I just don't think that anything raises or is brought, rather, to the court's attention that require a hearing in anything that's submitted to the court, even at that final hearing where testimony is taken. Now, as to the denial of effective assistance due to lack of preparation and so forth, I think that's more of an assumption than anything else on counsel's part here. There's nothing to indicate from the record that counsel is somehow deficient in preparing. Her motion for continuance is based on the fact in the early part, I think the first days of June, she had been in the hospital 4 days. And now on June 22nd, she's saying that because of that, she should get a continuance. That's on the day of trial. So I think the court is properly saying, look, that's not persuasive to me. and you really don't offer anything to show why you haven't been able to prepare in the time that was allotted or was available between that time and, for that matter, before. Appellant never identifies anything himself in any of his letters to the court or anything to suggest that she is not adequately prepared or not versed in the case or not talking to him competently about the case. When it's said that counsel failed to object to the extraneous offenses.
You know, one that also argued that,
yes, sir,
by the opposing counsel, that her failure to advise him that he needed to ask for a hearing, asking for new counsel, is effective assistance of the counsel.
I suppose you could say that, Judge. I think, and that maybe that's a fair argument, I think she raised it as herself and perhaps belatedly at the last minute, but at the point at which she could go back and, or he could go back and say, all right, here I am before the court, here's why I want a new attorney, even though it is the day of trial, one would expect him to go back and at least incorporate the things he's raised in his notes to the court, and he doesn't do so. What he's really complaining about at that point is he doesn't like the state's offer and hopes another attorney will get him a better offer. As far as, and I may be skipping around here, as far as the extraneous offenses that were admitted, I think the court did conduct, obviously, a balancing test, whether or not it was specifically requested or not. In fact, the court did exclude a portion of the recorded videotape that was offered in evidence at the guilt stage, and the rest of it then was offered after another objection at punishment. But the court did conduct its own balancing test. In fact, the state conducted a little bit of a concession to the defense in not offering evidence of another pending case, another pending drug case, at either phase of the trial. But
was
I do.
The whole video shown?
Yes, sir.
Wouldn't let part of it in.
Yes, sir. It was essentially, it was stopped at one point for guilt or innocence. That's the point at which he more or less goes through and confesses that he is at fault in making this methamphetamine, which is a fairly large amount. Mm-hmm. It stopped on the second portion that was offered at punishment. He goes on to volunteer a good deal of information about, well, he's done this a long time. The cops have never caught him. He's done it all over the county.
Well, I was just thinking about the balancing test.
Yeah. And I think
he still let the whole video in.
He did it punishment.
Punishment.
Yes, sir.
And
probably the most damaging in terms of the defense appellant himself is at that point he goes on to say, well, you know, what do you think I'll get, 10 years? The officers say, we don't know. And he goes on to say, well, I'll, something to the effect of I'll be right back doing it again. So obviously that's pretty harmful to him at punishment. I do disagree with counsel that Padron and Bible do flatly say there's no requirement of corroborating evidence in punishment as far as extraneous offenses that the defense himself confesses or testifies to. I think counsel's main objection was surprise at punishment stays. The problem with that is that these admissions on his part were not specific. I mean, he didn't say that a year ago on January 1st I manufactured methamphetamine. What he says was, I've been manufacturing methamphetamine for a long, long time, or words to that effect. So there's no way to make it more specific. On the other hand, I think Bible and Padron are clear that there is no corroboration requirement, no corpus delicti requirement, that it serves no purpose at the punishment phase to prevent a conviction based on a false confession. And there's nothing, certainly nothing, to suggest that the rule should be varied for first-time offenders. I think that's what I hear over and over again from counsel, is that because he was unversed in trial trials, he should get a break for not having some kind of grander or greater view of what goes on. Finally, on motion, let's see, the court failing to grant a hearing on the motion for new trial. First of all, I'd point out that the motion for new trial filed by counsel at that point does not really ask for a hearing on a motion for new trial. It's certainly not the prayer. What it does is in the body makes some remark that if certain things are substantiated, then he would be entitled to a motion for new trial. But there's no indication that it was prayed for, that an order was presented to the court to ask for a hearing, and I think that's fatal to raising the claim now. because the counsel raising a motion for new trial has an obligation to have the court set a hearing before it's overruled by operation of law, or he cannot complain of it later.
Now, the other side of that sword is ineffective assistance.
Could be, Your Honor. I think it's probably an oversight, but I think there's nothing to prevent it after it's filed from, you know, coming along, presenting a motion for hearing to the court. But I think it has to be done. I don't think, assuming that she wasn't, that this matter was preserved and the court was fairly presented with a request for a hearing for a motion for new trial. The problem there is this, is that you have the motion, you're not entitled to it based on the filing of it alone. There has to be something raised that raises issues not available from the record. I'm sorry.
The problem with the ineffective assistance on the failure to ask for a hearing on the motion for new trial is it wasn't trial counsel that filed that motion, it was appellate counsel. So, you can't piggyback that onto your other complaints against trial counsel because it wasn't heard.
That is correct. I think the motion attempts to feedback or go back into the trial itself by adjourant or swearing the counsel on motion for new trial saying all of this is true in the motion. But on the other hand, the motion, again, doesn't say anything that fairly raises an issue of ineffective assistance. What it does, I think, is recite, if I remember, that counsel was not prepared, that she should have objected to this or that, that there should have been a pretrial hearing. But it doesn't go into detail as to why that should have would amount to ineffective assistance in this particular case. The affidavit of the juror Jones is kind of puzzling. I mean, what it does is suggest that this would have made a difference if counsel had asked somebody along the way, well, the appellant's never had a felony conviction, has he? And that would probably be the better course. If this were a probation case, I think that would be fatal to the state. I think that would clearly be incompetence of counsel. But in this case, what Juror Jones really, all he does is say he thinks that. There's no indication that it was an active matter for consideration before the jury, that anyone discussed it, that it was ever anything more than something that popped into his head after the fact, when supposedly he read a newspaper, and I don't think this is even quoted in the affidavit. But read an article that mentioned the appellant had not been previously convicted of a felony, and at that point had some remorse over the jury assessing so strong a punishment. Although the case in itself was a 15 to 99 or life year range of penalty, and the amount of methamphetamine in question here of which evidence was offered was a very large amount. So I think the facts of the case itself could have warranted a jury assessing a strong punishment as they did. But there's so many indication of that being taken up or considered by the jurors at all, and his mental processes, certainly after the fact, which I think is all it vouches for, is not something that we can be inquired into as a legitimate grounds of granting a motion for new trial under Rule 606. It's certainly not. I think the affidavit goes on, or perhaps before that, quotes another juror to the effect of saying, well, I live somewhere relatively close to the defendant, and I want to make a strong statement. Again, under the cases under Rule 606, that does not amount to outside influence. It's the juror's own ratiocinations as to what she's thinking at the time, and even that does not indicate that the matter was discussed, taken up by other jurors, discussed during deliberations. It's something of a statement on her part as to what else was on her mind at one particular time, but I don't think it amounts to jury misconduct, certainly under Rule 606. So what we would argue to the court is that counsel had failed to show incompetence counsel here, ineffective assistance, I should say. Certainly it was not the best representation of the world. Other matters could have been done, but nothing is shown here that would have affected the outcome of the case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McGoy. Ms. Williams.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'd like to address one thing that stuck out in my mind in Mr. McGoy's argument is that the balancing test was done on the extraneous offenses at the guilt innocent phase, and it was. But then he goes on to say that the balancing test was done at the punishment phase, and the record is entirely void of that. He is referring to a comment made by trial counsel that he believes is a 403 objection, but the statement is actually, quote, "It is more prejudicial because they haven't given me adequate notice." If that was a 403 objection, as defense counsel would be in heaven right now. In regards to her deficient performance, one of the things that stood out the most in the record is when you look at volume 3, which is the guilt innocence phase of it. And in volume 3, you'll see that at the beginning, when the video is being introduced, she's making these very broad, nondescript objections to it. And then they break for the noon hour for her to go review the video. And she comes back, and in the guilt innocent phase, she has these very specific, articulable objections. Why weren't those done before trial? What is the trial strategy for not knowing that video inside and out prior to getting there? If you look at the totality of the representation and the defendant in his unique situation of being the first-time offender, you have a situation where ineffective assistance of counsel falls squarely in this case. She was deficient. It was unacceptable. And this case should be reversed on the fact that his counsel, trial counsel, was ineffective. In the alternative, because the state did try to buffer some of her incompetence at the guilt-innocent phase, we would ask that you at least reverse the punishment phase where the bulk of the ineffective assistance comes through. Again, with the ridiculous objection that she made to the extraneous offenses and the unacceptable not asking the question, has he ever been convicted of a felony before? And I do not, and truly, I think this is a case that should be completely reversed because the ineffective assistance flows straight through it from the beginning to the end. Her opening statement, "I'd like to withdraw from the case," to the not asking the question and ending on the video, basically. There's no trial strategy. There's nothing in there. I think the whole thing should be reversed. But no, I do not know of a case that just reverses on punishment only. I think it's possible to do that, though, because we have the two phases of a criminal trial, and that's what we would ask for. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Williams. Thank you, Mr. McGoy. Again, we appreciate your arguments. We appreciate your briefing and coming down to Fort Worth. Your case is submitted, and you all are excused. We will now adjourn.